everyone, and welcome to Downtown Mobile for tonight's Democratic Congressional Debate. I'm News 5's Peter Albrecht, joined by Robert Kennedy Jr. from FM Talk 106.5. Thank you for either watching or listening tonight. First, let's introduce the candidates who've been placed left to right in alphabetical order tonight. They are James Averhart, Rick Collins, and Kiani Gardner. We're going to quickly go over the rules for tonight. There will be no opening statements. The candidates will have 60 seconds to answer questions in the first portion of our show and 90 seconds in the second portion. A 30-second rebuttal will be allowed at the sole discretion of the moderators and only if a candidate specifically addresses an opponent. Questions will be answered tonight in a rotating order, and those questions have been established by WKRG News 5, FM Talk 106.5, and Kennedy for Alabama, and the candidates have no knowledge of the questions prior to the debate. We ask people in the audience to please refrain from any applause or any comments. So we're ready to go with our first question, which will kind of help you introduce yourself to the audience. And that question is simply, what personal or professional accomplishments set you apart from the other candidates on stage and also demonstrate that you are the best candidate for the job? And Mr. Averhart, you go first.
Thank you to WKRG Talk Radio 105 and the Democratic Party. Again, I am James Averhart. I'm a servant leader, a leader who's prepared and ready to serve the citizens of the 1st Congressional District. My training started in my community, Maysville, whereas I've had the opportunity to cut grass and make money and move up to Monroeville and had the opportunity to work on my grandfather's farm. But I entered the United States Marine Corps, and I served 30 years. I retired out the Pentagon. I've been the warden of three prisons and the head of Marine Corps Correction over all Marine Corps assets and equipment and personnel. I've had the opportunity to work on Capitol Hill, where I've authored a bill, Senate Bill 1527 and H.R. Bill 2442. And more so, and I've had the opportunity to move and more so work in the community with the homeless and retired veterans and veterans that need assistance. I didn't just start doing this because I'm running for office. This is a passion of mine. Mobile, the 1st Congressional District, as I've stated, I'm your return on investment. I'm a native Alabamian, and I moved back home to run for office and be your voice in Washington, D.C.
Mr. Collins.
Thank you, WKRG-TV, Kennedy for Alabama, and FM Talk 106.5 for having this event tonight. I've been a real estate broker in South Alabama for over 35 years, and as a real estate broker, my job is to bring people together for a win-win solution. I'm very proud of my professional and personal achievements in life. I'm running because of I can bring people together. I've got a great sense of humor, clear-headed, I'm honest, and trustworthy. Washington needs people that can bring folks together. Our country is very divided. Martin Luther King Jr. said, we must live together as brothers or perish together as fools. And I can bring unity to Washington and appreciate your support. Thank you.
And Ms. Gardner?
So when I finished my PhD, I made the very conscious choice to begin working in the community college, and specifically the technical and community college, because I believe that was one of the most immediate ways to invest in the middle class and invest directly in my community. That experience of building up our middle class, of helping people to change their lives through education, of democratizing education and opportunity, led me to this calling, this ability to say, I've got the skill set, I've got the passion, and I've got the experience to invest in our community, to build our middle class, to create jobs, to democratize education, and to increase opportunity for my family, for your family, and for all of the families of the 1st District.
In light of the U.S. Senate's decision to acquit the president, was the decision by the House of Representatives to impeach President Trump the correct one? And will this have a positive or a negative effect on the Democratic Party in the 2020 general election? Mr. Collins.
Yes, thank you. The House impeaching the president, I mean, I wasn't in the room, so I don't know all the facts of that, but I assume that they did it in good faith, and I supported that. The Senate, on the other hand, they abdicated their responsibility. Not calling witnesses is totally unacceptable, whether you're for or against the impeachment of the president. You have to have a fair and impartial and open hearing. That's what the American people expect. Thank you.
Dr. Gardner.
Absolutely. So the impeachment inquiry I fully supported, not necessarily impeachment in and of itself, but as a scientist, as someone who believes in facts and in data, I'm always in favor of an investigation that is intended to lead the American people towards the truth. Moving forward into the general election, I hope it doesn't have a lasting impact. It might, because of national talking points. But what my goal is in this election is to keep forcing the issues towards our local talking points. I don't want to talk about impeachment in 2020 because that's done. I want to talk about infrastructure. I want to talk about healthcare. I want to talk about education. And we serve this district best when we avoid these hot button issues that really have no bearing on the day-to-day lives of our citizens. And we drill down on the things that matter to us today: a living wage, the ability to raise a family, and have a good quality of life in Alabama.
Dr. Averhart.
That's a great thing about a democracy. And everything is a process. What I look at and what I've seen as it pertains to the impeachment, it went through all levels of government. Therefore, a thorough process was done. It doesn't matter if I like it or not, or if you like it or not, but what matters is this: that it's not about an individual, it's about protecting our Constitution. And that's what each one of those branches of government swore to do. I totally agree. I want to talk about the real issues that are affecting real people. There are a plethora of issues that are spoken about nationwide. Definitely in our district, as I've traveled our district with more than 7,000 miles down dirt roads included and knocking on doors. Let's talk about health care and those issues that are affecting real people. Why our senior citizens are having to choose whether they pay their electric bill or buy medication. These are real issues that we should talk about and have a discussion about.
Thank you. Our next question involves the presidential race. Who do you support as the Democratic presidential nominee? And how does this reflect where you are on the political spectrum? And Ms. Gardner, you're first.
Absolutely. So I'm going to support our Democratic presidential nominee, period. As far as who I'm voting for in the primary election, I'm going to be very frank with you. The only primary election that I'm focused on is my primary election. Where I fall in the political spectrum, based on my policies, is I am not necessarily Democrat or Republican. I am on Team Alabama, and I am on Team First District. So wherever that puts me in your spectrum, I'm fine with that. I'm for the working people here in this district.
Mr. Averhart, you're next.
I am ready to support anyone that becomes the president of our United States. I've had the opportunity to work in my 30 years, work for five presidents of the United States, five administrations, and I know how to be impartial. I know how to talk across the aisle. I know how to work the congressional floor. So what I will say is this: I'm focusing on my campaign, Team Averhart, ensure that we get out here and meet and talk to the citizen of the first congressional district. But as it pertains, I look to support anyone that's running for president of these United States.
Mr. Collins.
Of course, I'll support the Democratic nominee for president. I haven't zeroed in on exactly who I'm voting for. There's two or three that I'm looking at. And like the others, I have to pay more attention to my campaign than theirs. So I'll probably zero in on a candidate. Thank you.
Prior to tonight, we asked our viewers on WKRG News 5 to email some of the questions that you'd like to see answered tonight. And Roseanne Haven is standing by with one of those questions.
Yes, thank you, Peter. This question comes from our viewer, Allie, and she emailed this to us. Congressman Bradley Byrne recently said Democrats don't believe in God. Former Senator Jeff Sessions says the left wants to destroy religion. What's your reaction to these comments?
And Ms. Gardner, you're first on this one.
So to Bradley Byrne, as a Christian woman and as one of his constituents, the first thing I would have to say to him is shame on you. Shame on you to use religion in general and my religion to sow seeds of discord in my community. As a Democratic candidate and as a God-fearing and faithful woman, my goal is not to remove faith, but to lead on my faith. And my faith is one that tells me that we protect the least of these, that I step out in faith and I act on behalf of the homeless, of the hungry, of children, and I protect every member of my community. So shame on you for using faith in a transactional way to credit and debit to your own political desires and motives. I will not stand for it as your constituent, as a voter, and as a congresswoman. Shame on you.
Mr. Collins.
Well, true leaders unite people. Only fools and cowards divide us. So I'm not going to get involved in answering Bradley Byrne or Jeff Sessions on something like that. I don't think it's productive. I'm going to Washington to unite people. And I can work across the aisle, but I just ignore rhetoric like that. Thank you.
And Mr. Eberhardt.
I don't indulge concur with divisiveness, and I will definitely not speak negatively in regards to anyone on this campaign to break them down to build myself up. But what I will say is simply this. I am a God-fearing man. First of all, I understand the difference between church and state. I'm a God-fearing man. My PhD is theology and biblical studies. So, you know, anyone that questions religion, that's on them. That's a great thing about a democracy, again, that you have free will and free choice. So I will simply say that, you know, as we move forward, again, I want to talk about the real issues that affect the real people. And I tell you what, you know, if it's talk about being a Christian or Christianity, and they believe in God, well, God is love. So I embrace all. I love humanity. I love all.
Shifting to local issues, is it important to build a new I-10 bridge over the Mobile River and Bay? If so, what specifically would you do to secure federal funding for the project so that it can be financed without a toll?
Absolutely.
And this starts with Mr. Collins.
Yeah, I really like this question. I'll start out by saying, you know, the Democrats control the U.S. House of Representatives. And as we know, whoever controls the House has more access to infrastructure monies for roads and bridges. So if we send a Republican representative to Congress this term, they're going to have no ability to help with that issue. In fact, I don't think they could get an $800 speed bump put on the Bayway. But as far as I'm going to ask the state to look at some temporary relief. There's a route that you could take. You could route traffic around parts of Mobile and all of Pensacola by using I-65 and the Perdido exit and so forth. I won't get details on that, but I will ask the state of Alabama to look at that. I think we could relieve a lot of the traffic and divert traffic around our two cities. It only adds about 21 miles to the total trip from I-10 to Crestview, Florida. So thank you.
Dr. Eberhardt.
I truly believe that there should be a bridge, you know, Interstate 10 bridge, and however, I do not support the toll, but what I will do, I will look for means and ways. That's what a representative does. As your representative, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to seek money. The money is there, without a doubt. You know, we have to go out there as the representative and find the money, find, you know, how to bring that money and direct that money to Alabama for that specific reason. I would love to be on the infrastructure committee and to be able to advocate for the first district and more so for this project. However, I lived in areas that had tolls and, you know, more so areas that built bridges. There's ways to build this bridge without money, more so without a toll. Let's focus on this lottery. That's ways that we can build this bridge, but we have to come to the table. We have to sit down, and we have to bring the smart people to the table and figure it out and establish some communication to do that.
Dr. Gardner.
So I absolutely agree with my colleagues that we need infrastructure, particularly a bridge. We need funding. But I disagree with them on the fact that they think that a freshman member of Congress is going to walk in and demand millions of dollars for this bridge when every district in the nation needs infrastructure. We don't just need someone advocating for money. Every district wants money for bridges and roads and sewer systems. We need someone who can think about this problem and propose novel ideas. We know climate change legislation is going to be a major point of the budget moving forward. Well, we've got a bridge that is vulnerable based on its position on the bay. We live in an area that is vulnerable to climate change, to severe weather, based on our position on the bay. So what I propose is infrastructure funding linked to progressive and also proactive climate change updates to say we have a need that supersedes the needs of maybe some of our more inland districts in the Midwest. We need our bridge more than maybe Iowa needs to pave some of its roads. And when you really drill down at what makes us special, we can get our fair share and hopefully even a little bit more.
All right, for our next question, let's go fishing. Many in Lower Alabama are unhappy with the federal limits placed on red snapper season. Do you believe the management of snappers should remain at the federal level or be moved to a state level? And how would you facilitate that if you agree with that? And Mr. Eberhardt, you answer this one first.
Great. That's a great question. And I also like to add that my colleague is definitely correct in regards to a freshman member. That's why as a junior freshman, you go there, you find advocates, you build bridges and establish establish relationships as it pertains to the fishery and the red snappers. The same thing applies. You know, I will continue to advocate for our citizens, the members of the 1st Congressional District, as it pertains to the red snapper. And that's what I will do. I will find a senior sponsor, and we have them right here in Alabama as well. Those congressional representatives know exactly what's going on in Mobile, so we have to find those who are going to support us and to sponsor that bill, and that's what I will do.
Ms. Gardner?
So I love red snapper here. In fact, it's one of my favorite things to do outdoors in Lower Alabama. I fully support conservation efforts, and I actually support them on the state level. I would like to see federal funding go towards funding research and conservation and really allow some of our state representatives or agencies to oversee our conservation efforts. As a scientist, I know no one's an expert in everything, but we do have local experts that care greatly about their local environment and our local economy that comes from that environment. So from the federal level, I advocate for funding to give them all of the resources they need to best be stewards of this beautiful area that we call home.
Mr. Collins?
Yes, I've been watching over the past 20 to 30 years the federal government get involved in fishing in stock and in the state. And it always seemed like to me the state had their act together and knew how to control it and to monitor it. And good news is the federal government last year approved Amendment 50, which would allow the five Gulf states to have more control over the snapper population, the season, the limits, and the sizes. So it's trending in the right direction. I think Alabama finally was able to prove to the feds that they knew better than they did. So thank you.
Our rural counties have challenges creating good, high-paying jobs, specifically in Washington, Monroe, Clark, and Escambia County. How would you use your platform and access to federal dollars to create job opportunities that extend beyond Mobile and Baldwin County? And for this one, we'll start with Dr. Averhart.
That's a great question. As I've stated, I have significant ties up in Monroe County, more specific, Beatrice, Alabama. I've seen factories close down. I often wonder, how are the citizens surviving? You know, the main area up there is they deal with forestry. That's the main way to that they survive. There are more log truck drivers up there than a little bit. But the thing about it is, what I would do is continue to advocate for funding, you know, advocate for funding. But we have to prepare ourselves in the district. There are highways, and more so, it's an infrastructure issue. You have to be prepared to move those products out of the city. It's not going to work on those one-lane roads. Okay, so we have to widen those roads in order to get the product out. And again, and that will help with economic development, small businesses and such, you know, to move and grow.
Mr. Collins.
A couple issues. The small counties, Escambia, Monroe, and Washington counties, and you won't hear the Republicans talking about this, but the timber owners, the large out-of-state corporations that own most of the timber in the state and in those counties, are way underpaying taxes on timber, and that needs to be looked into. I think Escambia County is probably leaving $800,000 to $850,000 a year on the table, and Monroe, like $650,000. There was a study done by a retired Auburn professor that broke all that down, and it's very good information. The other thing, if we expand Medicaid in these small hospitals and communities, that's going to bring, you know, the feds are paying 90 cents on the dollar for Medicaid expansion. So for 10 cents on the dollar, we can really support our local hospitals and keep them vibrant and alive, because some of them have closed in the past few years. Thank you.
Dr. Gardner.
So we have an economy in South Alabama that for a very long time was a manufacturing economy. And in many places it still is, but unfortunately we've seen the loss of manufacturing facilities and the loss of jobs. Again, on the federal level, there are things that you can think about to perhaps position Alabama in the best place for job growth. And one of the things that I think about particularly is Alabama's role as an energy producer. Where we do produce paper nowadays, why don't we produce energy? As you start to look at federal legislation and budgets moving towards a goal of clean energy, Alabama, as already a large energy producing state, stands well positioned to insert itself into that gap and become a key factor in our switch to eventual clean and totally renewable energies. We've got a great climate for it. We've got actually all of the great the best pieces possible for renewable energy. All we need is an actual investment in building up that industry here while still protecting and phasing in jobs for our citizens.
Our next question has to do with environmental protection versus business. How do we strike a balance between protecting our beaches and our growing tourism industry while at the same time fostering a friendly environment to energy industries and other industries? And Rick Collins, you're first.
Yes, thank you. I've got a unique perspective. I've been a commercial real estate broker for 35 years, so I'm pro-business, always have been. But back in 2003, I got involved. ExxonMobil was going to put a liquid gas plant on Mobile Bay at the Navy Homeport site, and I got involved in that effort to stop that. And it wasn't because I was against business, it's because I was against oil and gas taking over the shoreline of Mobile Bay like it's done in Louisiana and Texas. So I'm pro-business, but there is a line, and I thought it was important for the citizens of Mobile to decide how we wanted to grow, and by helping to stop that plant, we changed the direction of growth in Mobile, and I'm very proud of that effort. Thank you.
Kiani Gardner.
So I'm going to push back on the question a little bit. I refuse to buy in to this false narrative that you can either be pro-environment or pro-business, particularly in South Alabama, where our environment is our economy. There are ways to do environmental protection in a very pro-business and business-friendly model. We will require our businesses and our corporations in South Alabama to be good stewards of the land. We will not give them a free pass to dump whatever they care to in the waters, because as you all know, 60% of all of the water in Alabama state dumps into our bay. When we protect our environment, we protect our beaches and our tourism economy. We protect our fisheries and our aquaculture economy. We protect our port and our shipping and transport economy. So you can write legislation that holds businesses accountable in a fair way to the environment and allows us to keep growing our economy environmentally and sustainably.
And James Eberhardt.
I totally agree with my colleague in regards to the environment and the business. I totally agree with that. On the same token, I would simply say that add to that, that needs to be some oversight. That needs to be transparency and accountability as it pertains to the business and our environment. We all have an inherent obligation to do so because our environment is, you know, that's how we live, and it helps with our survival.
Thank you. For the next question, we're going to talk about an international issue that has a local impact. What are the impacts of tariffs and trade wars on the local economy and on foreign investment in Southwest Alabama? Please include the impact to the agricultural industry in your answer, starting with Dr. Gardner.
Absolutely. So I'm very proud, in fact, to be in this congressional race the only candidate who's spoken publicly about the impacts and the dangers of tariffs on our economy. We are a port economy. Trade wars immediately impact the flow of goods in and out of our port. There is a false belief that someone wins in a trade war. There are no winners in trade wars. Trade is not a zero-sum game. So we need to be implementing trade policies that don't just protect our local producers, but protect international consumers as well. We all know that right now, Airbus is a major manufacturer in this area. Tariffs stand to cripple Airbus's ability to manufacture airplanes and thus cripple growth in this area. Farmers are particularly impacted. The recent trade war has cut off many American farmers to whole swaths of their market. And in fact, in the last year, family farm bankruptcies were at an all-time high, jumping 20% in 2019. Tariffs are damaging and dangerous.
Dr. Eberhardt.
I totally agree again. The tariffs are dangerous. You know, at this point in time, you know, as we see different countries import exports being tariffed, and as it pertains to Mobile and Airbus, that's right here in our backyard, you know, receiving those taxes and those, on those airplane parts, but I cannot just talk about Airbus and not talk about Alstom as well. And I totally agree as it pertains to our farmers and the manufacturers and those who are making the equipment and so forth. Our farmers have taken the largest hit out of all. You know, everyone has taken a hit, but our farmers definitely has taken a hit, you know, in this regards.
Mr. Collins.
Thank you. It's interesting. The Constitution actually grants Congress the right to impose tariffs, but over time, Congress has kind of relinquished that over to the executive branch. But my job in Congress will be to protect local jobs and industries. So if there's a tariff threatening that, of course, I'll step in. And also trying to keep up with NAFTA. We just did away with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement between Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., and replaced it. And so learning about all the intricacies of that new new trade agreement would be important. The Airbus, fortunately for us, the parts coming from Europe for Airbus were not included in the new tariff on Airbus. If you buy a jumbo jet from Airbus Europe and bring it here, it's a 10% tariff. But fortunately, the parts coming to Airbus Mobile are not included. So we're ramping up production, 130 planes a year for the A320 in Mobile. So that's good news there. Thank you.
Here's our next question. Do you believe in global warming? And if so, how do you help those Americans who deny climate change to better understand your perspective? And Keani Gardner, you're first.
So, yes, I'm a scientist, and I believe in global warming. In fact, let's be clear, scientists believe in global warming. I don't think the majority of Americans think global warming is a hoax. We hear it a lot from people who find it politically expedient to negate that truth. But the fact of the matter is global warming is real. I don't believe we need to educate the general public about the truth of this. It's not that hard to notice that your seasonal allergies that were once 1 month in duration are now 8 months long. In February, I already saw pollen on the ground. Actually, I saw it last month in January. What we really need to do, though, is address the huge privilege it is to worry about what the world will look like in 20 years. We have large populations of South Alabamians that are worried about feeding their children, paying their rent, and finding a job today. And when you don't know if you're going to be able to survive until the end of the week, sea level rise seems like a very, very distant problem. So if we're going to address climate change appropriately, we need to first address the basic needs of our citizens.
Rick Collins.
You know, the ice cap's melting. There's a lot of proof out there, a lot of scientists that say that it's real. And, you know, we've been propping up the oil and gas and the fossil fuel industries for over 100 years to the tune of, I think in recent years, $10 to $12 billion a year in subsidies for oil and gas industries. We can't pull the rug out from under them at one time. Gas and oil prices would go up too quickly for our economy. But I think we need to start phasing down and subsidizing alternative energy companies and also public transportation. That would be my approach to it. But, yeah, I think it's real. Thank you.
James Averhart.
Yes, sir. It's real. And what we need to do, again, I truly believe that in education. We definitely need to educate our citizens. Although they may see what's going on, sometimes we may have to run, do some marketing and promotion, you know, more so have some classes in regards to our citizens in the community and such. We have to make a big deal out of it, you know, and that's what I see that we're not doing. Nobody wants to talk about this issue. And, you know, as far as our, you know, trying to convince someone if it's real or not, I totally agree. They know it's real, but sometimes we have to press the issue and talk about these issues that really hurt.
All right, thank you very much. We're about to take a short break, but before we do, let's check back in with Roseanne to find out what's ahead in tonight's debate.
All right, thank you, Peter. I got to tell you, a lot of really good questions in the first half hour. A lot of interest here, as I can tell you, we've had to bring chairs in. It is standing room only. A lot of people want to hear what these Democratic candidates have to say. In the next half hour, we are going to tackle even bigger issues and allow the candidates just a little more time to answer your questions. You don't have to be here to participate. All you have to do is log on to one of social media pages of WKRG News 5, submit your questions, and we may pose those to the candidates. Keep it right here on News 5. We have much more. WKRG News 5 is your local election headquarters.
And welcome back, everyone, to the Gulf Quest Maritime Museum in downtown Mobile. Glad you're joining us for tonight's Democratic congressional debate. We're going to move on now and talk about some national issues. The candidates in this segment will have 90 seconds maximum to give us their answers. In the last 3 years, we've seen some of the largest deficits in U.S. history. Do you believe that the growing national debt is a problem? And if so, how would you address it? And we'll begin with Rick Collins.
Yes, our deficit, you know, this is a really good economy. And we budgeted a $1 trillion deficit this year. And the federal debt is $23 to $24 trillion today. The interest payment on that debt just this year is $479 billion. Our total defense budget is $700 billion, so that's pretty close. We have got to focus on reducing our federal debt. And adding $1 trillion in a good year is unacceptable. I would start next year with a zero deficit budget and then set a 15 to 20 year goal to reduce the total debt by 50% over that 15 to 20 years. Thank you.
James Eberhardt.
You know, as we speak about the deficit, you know, I just like to simply say, you know, who's creating the narrative? I haven't seen those numbers. You know, I know what's being told. What I think we should do is definitely sit down with our economists, those individuals who are dealing with money, and really sit around the table and just create the conversation to see where we're truly at and see how we can move forward to lower the deficit.
Okay. Kiani Gardner?
We absolutely need to address our deficit. One of the fastest ways we do it is we stop this system of corporate socialism that we've allowed to fester for these last few years. Everyone is so worried about the cost of paying for SNAP or healthcare when in reality, large bailouts for corporations and multinational banks are what's got us where we are. We refuse to give money to and tax breaks particularly, to these corporations that are willing to make profits on the back of our country. Because as we all know, and as my mama taught me very well, when you owe someone a dollar, they're gonna come to collect. And we need to have more fiscal responsibility in our leadership that protects Americans, allows for trade to resume with the rest of the world, and brings our deficit back under control.
The next question has to do with education. When it comes to public education, what do you believe the federal role should be? And given your philosophy, how would you use your access to federal dollars to improve outcomes for our youth who are attending underperforming schools? And we'll start with Dr. Eberhardt.
So, as it pertains to education, again, what I would do in my position as your representative is continue to advocate for the funds to ensure programs will not be stopped as it pertains to our schools and the educational system. That's the main thing we need to do. Most of what I would do is continue to advocate for the funds to continue to go to the schools.
Dr. Gardner.
Sure. The role of the federal government as it pertains to public education is really twofold, I believe, in funding that education fully and in setting standards that allow us to not just measure benchmarks of our students' success, but also allow us to dig into the data and find out the ways that we need to invest more heavily in our students. The federal government's funding should go towards not just teacher pay and curriculum design, but also support staff in our schools to continue a healthy and safe learning environment for our students. Federal funds should be used for not just nurses on campus, but for mental health professionals that students can have access to on campus. Not just books and computers, but also professional development, the opportunity for advancement for our teachers so that they have a vested interest in not just the students, but in continuing their professional growth as they go through the years. Our federal government needs not just to throw dollars at this problem, but to also throw solutions and look at the data in order to really dig down and find out the ways that we best train our students for success.
Mr. Collins.
We have a lack of leadership on education, federal level, state, and local in some cases. We really need everybody to get together and say, hey, we're going to raise our public education to the top 10% in the nation. And everybody focused on that, federal representative included, of course. We've got a lot of issues. We've got shortage of math and science teachers and special education teachers. The good news is last year Alabama did pass the largest education budget at $7.1 billion with an across-the-board 4% raise. So there's some good news, and they added 164 pre-K classes. So there's some positive things happening. I am against Amendment 1, which would take the voting away from the State Board of Education. We can't vote anymore. I'm against that. we should be able to vote on that. I am for term limits, though. They have unlimited terms at this time, and I'm for term limits on Board of Education members. Thank you.
Prior to tonight, we asked our WKRG News 5 viewers to submit their questions, and Roseanne Haven is standing by with some of those.
Yes, thank you, Peter. This next question from our viewer is also about education. In fact, higher education and the cost associated with that. The question is, do you believe four-year undergraduate public colleges should be free? Do you believe student loan debt should be canceled? If the answer to either is yes, please explain how you intend to pay for it.
And James Eberhardt, you're first.
Okay. We know that nothing is free. I don't think it should be, the loan should be free. However, I think it should be lower. And we should work at ways to lower it. You know, use those federal funds to do so. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the, don't remember the first part of that question.
Well, there was kind of a two-parter. One was, should four-year public colleges be free, and should we relieve student loan debt that it exists?
So, I do not think it should be free. Again, those two-year colleges, those colleges have to operate as well. However, I should think that those fundings should be, the school, it should be lower.
Okay, Rick Collins?
I don't really know enough about if it's free colleges, then who's going to pay for it? So I don't really know the answer to that one. I don't think students' debt should be just waived. There's a lot of people who have paid off student debts, and I don't think it's fair just to waive student debts for the current. I do think, though, what we're doing locally and we need to do more of is training for high school students. We're doing that with Airbus. Airbus partnered with BC Rain High School, a great program for aerodynamic mechanic work and training, and I think that's a lot of promise there. We need to elevate, you know, college education isn't for everyone. There's a lot of great, I mean, plumbing, electricians, all kind of great careers out there. And students just going to college and coming out with a lot of debt is not always the best plan. So I would encourage more job training, high schools for different type trades. Thank you.
Keani Gardner.
As someone who's invested my career in the community college and the technical colleges, I don't necessarily agree that four-year public colleges should be free, but I do think that two-year public colleges should be free, or at least the first 2 years at a four-year institution. This isn't just to get your associates, but it's also a way to learn a trade at many of our technical institutions. An associate of science or an associate of applied science are absolutely necessary steps in today's economy towards a living wage and a high-paying job. As far as student debt, I don't think that student debt should be totally canceled. In many cases, that will over-advantage people who've already been privileged enough to rack up $500,000 in debt going to four-year schools, master's programs, and medical school. But I do believe that there are many, many students who had to invest in a bachelor's degree in order to enter into their profession that are saddled with unreasonable debt. I believe in debt forgiveness to a limit. My suggestion is probably $50,000, which is very close to the average four-year tuition expense for a four-year college. And then, of course, you've got interest and fees. So paying for it is going to come with a massive overhaul of our tax structure. We have an upside-down tax structure that it already advantages the very wealthy, the families whose students didn't need to go into debt to get that MD. So we fix that tax structure. We have Americans pay their fair share, and we democratize education in a way that gives people real opportunity in our economy.
The next question is related to healthcare. There are three healthcare philosophies being discussed during the current election cycle. The first is the Affordable Care Act as it exists today. The second is a public option to compete with the private insurance industry. And the third is Medicare for All with the elimination of private insurance. Which of these do you endorse, and how do you intend to pay for it? And we'll start with Mr. Collins.
I'm not for gutting the Affordable Care Act. I've benefited personally. I've had a lot of medical issues in my past, and I almost lost our family health insurance coverage back in 2008, and I was within 30 days of losing it, and I know what it's like to be on the verge of losing your health insurance. And at that time, there was pre-existing protection, so if I would have lost it, my private insurance company would have definitely dropped me. So I would not like to, I don't want to gut the Affordable Care Act. I'd like to keep it, the good components of it in place. I'm sorry about the last part of that question.
And if you endorse one of those, how do you intend to pay for it?
Oh, I'm not for Medicare for All. I think there needs to be a public option with private competition. I think it's good for both if we keep the competition in it. So I would be for getting in Congress and working through. I think the public's demanding that we have a public option, and I think that's where we're going as a country. I'd like to be a part of that discussion to try to keep the competition to the private-public choice. Thank you.
Dr. Gardner.
So here's the problem with that question. It's erroneously framed that it's a competition versus socialist model. There's no competition in our medical system and our insurance system right now because there's no price transparency. How can there be competition if you don't know how much something costs, how much your competitor's charging for it, and how much you can charge for it to be the best price? I think we keep the Affordable Care Act now because it is not perfect, but it is progress. And then we work on our system to get to a place where there actually is competition, where we lower prices, and once we get prices under control, then we can start to look at how we actually provide universal health care for all of our citizens. In the long run, and philosophically, I love the idea of universal health care, but I also know that it's going to take us some time to get there. Just like Kennedy said, at the end of the decade, we'll put a man on the moon. At the end of this decade, let's have the goal of having free health care, of having the right to live and be healthy where you are in Alabama. And let's start taking steps towards that goal instead of bickering over what the perfect plan might be tomorrow. We are in a system that is so broken, you only survive if you're lucky or rich. Let's start getting through that, and then we can get to a system that works for all of us.
Dr. Averhart.
It's unfortunate, a country like the United States of America, that we don't have health care for all or free health care. But what I would support and endorse is that Affordable Care Act, with the modification to include pre-existing conditions and oversight over insurance companies, because that's what the battle is at to me.
All right, let's talk a little bit about some foreign policy issues. President Trump has fostered relationships with Vladimir Putin of Russia, Kim Jong-un of North Korea, and the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, while at the same time he's distanced himself from some longtime U.S. allies like France and Germany and England. What are the ramifications of this? And Ms. Gardner, you're first.
Sure. The ramifications of his personal relationships, to be perfectly honest, I'm not interested in. But what I do know is while he was building these friendships, China cut our farmers off from millions of dollars of their soybean market. While he was building these relationships, Russia threatened the very founding ideals of our democracy and interfered in the people's right to free and fair elections. While he was building these relationships, Saudi Arabia murdered an American citizen in its embassy. His relationships are his own business, but these relationships have set a very wide path towards policies and international agreements that have put the lives and livelihoods of Americans in very real danger. So my interest is not in why President Trump decided to build these relationships. My interest is in reopening the Chinese market to our farmers. My interest is ensuring that American citizens abroad are safe in our embassies. My interest is ensuring that when you go to the ballot box to vote, your vote counts. It counted as you meant it, and it has a real implication in our democracy. That is what I'm interested in.
James Averhart.
You know, as a service member who served, individual who served 30 years in the United States Marine Corps, and talking about this issue, I'm very passionate. It's personal to me, in a sense. However, I've never been a president of the United States. Who knows what those leaders are going through? I know how to be impartial. I know how to follow the orders in which I am giving, and I know how to support. And that's what we need to look at now on a broader scale. Yes, we need our allies. Who knows why the president is making friends with Korea, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and so forth. But what I do know, as a service member, our job is to do what we're told. We support. So thank you.
Rick Collins.
Our Constitution spells out clearly that Congress has the exclusive authority to declare war. And the executive branch, their job is to carry out that declaration. We have not done that for 70 years. We haven't declared war since World War II. Both parties are responsible. Congress has abdicated their responsibility. And so you fast forward to like we withdrew out of Syria recently last year, and our Kurdish allies are now real vulnerable to attack by Turkey. We've started heating up bad relations with Iran, and none of this is happening with congressional input. And Congress needs to step back up to the plate because we need to be accountable. As a representative from Congress, I need to have to sit down with you and tell you this is important enough for your niece, nephew, grandchildren, or son or daughter to be in harm's way. If that standard is not met, we should not be putting our troops in other lands. Thank you.
Continuing with Iran, do you believe the president acted appropriately when he ordered a drone strike on the Iranian general? If not, why not? If so, do you believe he should have informed the relevant members of Congress prior to executing that operation? And we will start with Dr. Gardner.
So first off, no. I do not believe that was appropriate action. There was no indication and no evidence of an immediate threat to American lives, American safety, or our country. And so that was a gross overstep on our executive branch's power. Second part of the question?
Well, it was, if so, do you believe he should have informed Congress in advance?
Yes, we need to have an actual rebuilding of appropriate procedures and communication in D.C. on all levels. There are co-equal branches of government for a reason. There was absolutely no reason for his personal attorney to be informed of this airstrike ahead of the Speaker of the House. Regardless of whatever relationships you might have in D.C., we have a constitution that protects the three branches of government's power such that we have a true democracy. And with that overstep, President Trump showed his scorn for the American democratic process.
Thank you. Mr. Collins.
Of course, I don't have access to the intelligence about this person and how dangerous he was. It was an imminent threat, or was it just a bad guy? If we go around killing just bad guys, we're going to be pretty busy. Yes, I think Congress should be involved in all these decisions, and it's unacceptable that we're not. Thank you.
Dr. Eberhardt.
No, there are laws of war. It doesn't matter what we do. There are laws of war. You have the Geneva Convention, you know, that has oversight. You have NATO that has oversight. As it pertains to the president's action and in regards to the general that was assassinated, yes, that was an overstep. Congress, not the Gang of Eight, Congress, the House, should have been notified, and they should have definitely went through those proper procedures to award and more so give approval for that the action to take place. You know, as we look at the actions of Congress, that is their duty. I totally agree with the War Powers Act. It should be, you know, reinstituted, and more so, you know, that needs to be followed up, because anything that we do, there's accountability. American soldiers and sailors and Marines and airmen, they're not toy soldiers. These are real people who put their lives on the line every day. And they don't have a problem with doing it because, again, they're going to do what they're told when they're told, despite how they may feel, and especially when our leadership gives them the order to do it.
We're going to move from Iran to its neighbor, Iraq, where they've passed a non-binding resolution suggesting that U.S. troops leave that country. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think the U.S. should remove troops from Iraq? And Rick Collins, you're first.
Yeah, Peter, again, I really don't know the ins and outs of the intelligence on something like that, so I'm really not qualified to answer it. Thank you.
Okay. Next is James Eberhardt.
You know, the question again, there's a lot of time, a lot of money, funding that's been put into Iraq, Afghanistan, and such. You know, we'll build bases over there. We'll build, as we take ground, we build up. We have equipment there. We'll build schools and such. Now, if the relationship has been destroyed, and I think we need to lead that to the leadership, those individuals that are around the table that have the proper intelligence to know why we should keep that stronghold, then we need to probably stay. If not, then we need to definitely lead the country. But I'm all for bringing our troops home, because I have friends, and I know some that are there now, and I have friends who have laid down their lives on the battlefield there. So I'm not happy that they're there. So,
all right. Thank you. Keani Gardner?
Yeah. So this is personal for me as well. My little brother actually celebrated his 21st birthday in Iraq. He's home, and he's safe, so I'm thankful for that. But this resolution to expel our troops from any country, we must take seriously. Because at the end of the day, it's the safety of American men and women that we're gambling with. There was a time when a strong military presence in any country was the only way to ensure adequate intelligence for us to be able to maintain a position of power and maintain a position of peace in our world. But that is no longer the case. This resolution to pull our troops out of Iraq is directly related to our strikes in Iran. And as you look at that, that's directly related to our relationships with Russia. We have created a situation where we have allowed the situation to spiral so far out of control that we have thousands of men and women in real harm's way. And the question then is, what do we stand to gain by keeping these men and women in a country where they are not welcome, in a country where there is hostility towards them? We've already seen 30 injuries, 30 brain injuries for our servicemen. If we don't have a good reason to have them there, they need to be home.
The next two questions relate to the voters in the primary as well as the general election. In the state of Alabama, African American voters comprise between 60 and 70% of the electorate in the Democratic Party primary. What have you done to connect with members of the African American community, and what have you learned that will help you better represent the African American community and all communities if you are elected? We'll start with Dr. Averhart.
Well, that's a great question. You know, when I decided to, when I saw the numbers, what I decided to do is make it personal. As I've stated, as I traveled the first congressional district, it's all about effective communication, establishing relationships. That means I'm not just focusing on Baldwin County and Mobile County. I'm up in Washington County, Escambia County, Clark County, and Monroe County, down those dirt roads, knocking on doors, going in Miss Sally's kitchen, sitting on the porch talking, you know, in the backyard, going to churches and so forth, creating relationship, inspiring people, educating people. I mean, what I see is this. People have lost their trust in our current system, our current government. They often think and say, my vote don't count. They already know who they're going to vote for. And we spend time, you know, trying to talk to those individuals. You see, this is not just a black issue or a white issue. Or, you know, it's a people's issue. And what we have to do mostly is establish relationship. This is what we're failing. Thank you.
Dr. Gardner.
So this question supposes that my relationship with any community is predicated upon me being a candidate. My relationship with my community is because I live in this community. My relationship with every member of this community is because I want to see all of us prosper. And my relationship with any particular Democratic voter is based on the fact that we have the very same ideals. For this election, I haven't changed my tack. If we're going to be very frank, I've always invested in having a diverse community, a diverse church, a diverse school for my children, because I am a multi-ethnic, multicultural woman raising a multi-ethnic, multicultural family in South Alabama. It would be disingenuous of me to say my only interest in a black voter is as a voter. My interest in every person in Alabama is as a human, is as a mother who wants my children to have more opportunities than I did, and as a mother who wants your children to have more opportunities than you did as well, as someone who wants your voice to count at the ballot box every single time, no matter your district or your precinct or your political party. I have been reaching out very strategically to Democratic voters, not because they happen to be black or white, but because these are people that share my ideals, that believe in education and health care and equity and opportunity. And those are the voters that I'm speaking to. Those are the voters that I'm asking for their support on March 3rd.
Mr. Collins.
Yeah, I would like to have all the voters vote for me in the Democratic primary. But I have been changed. I've been spending a lot of time in African-American churches, two every Sunday since November. And it's changed me. It's the warmth and the welcome is something I couldn't imagine. And so my experiences in the community have been powerful for me, and hopefully I've touched somebody. I know I've been touched greatly. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to take a break here coming up in just a little bit. We'll be going off air, but we'll be continuing on WKRG.com and also on FM Talk 106.5. Roseanne Haven's going to tell us what's ahead in this next half hour and how you at home can participate.
Yes, we are going to continue to take your questions via online. We encourage you to go to our social media pages and submit your questions. We have a packed house here at the Gulf Quest Maritime Museum, but we still have much more ahead as this is going to continue to go on Facebook, on WKRG.com. We encourage you to participate. A lot of interesting comments so far online, and we have more comments to come that we're going to read and questions to ask. So we encourage you to keep it right here on WKRG throughout the evening. If you want to join in on this debate, you can do so online, and we'll have a recap of today's debate tonight on News 5 at 10 o'clock. For now, I'm Roseanne. Keep going on WKRG.com and Facebook. Much more to come. News 5 is your local election headquarters.
This next question, again, talks about the constituency of the party. There was a point in time when the Democratic Party included a significant number of white, middle-class, working voters. Many of those people now vote Republican. Many argue against their economic self-interest. How do you and the party get these people back under the Democratic umbrella? And James Averhart, you're first with this question.
It's a great question. What I see, because I talk to everyone, I don't just focus on black votes as well. I talk to everyone because they are a voter. When I talk to people, individuals who are Republicans that used to be Democrats, and some have come back over, you know, as I've spoken with them, again, they have lost the trust and the confidence in the party. You know, they saw things that they don't believe in. They saw what they thought to be divisiveness. They talked about racism. Yes. You have Caucasian men and women talk about racism that they see. You know, I think racism comes about with ignorance, and that may be another subject. But when I talk to those individuals, at the end of the day, they have lost the trust and the confidence in the party.
Rick Collins?
Yeah, I would have considered myself independent 15 or 20 years ago, and I started moving away from any idea of the Republican Party, environmental issues and healthcare and on and on. I think my belief is the Democratic Party is poised to really take over the landscape of the country, and I say that because the Republican Party is very narrow and very exclusive. And there's not room for people. If you don't line up with the views of the Republican Party, and I'm not going to bash the party any further than this, but that party has really become exclusive. And I think the Democratic Party has a larger tent. And I think ultimately the Democratic Party will, the next 10 years, I think it's going to be a big wave of blue wave in this country. Thank you.
Kiani Gardner.
So one of the things that our party has not done well historically is to challenge some of the national narratives. This narrative that as a Democrat, I don't believe in God. I challenge that. This narrative that as a Democrat, I couldn't possibly have sound economic policy and understand how tariffs work. I challenge that. One of the things we do as Democrats is we challenge the narrative and we talk about the issues that matter to voters. And as we keep drilling down on the fact that that toll was a tax, don't let them tell you otherwise, on the fact that you deserve to see a doctor when you need to see a doctor, on the fact that your children deserve to come out of high school ready to enter work or enter college. When we talk about those issues that matter to every family in Alabama, we will find that voters will want to vote on issues. I say this very frankly to my Republican Alabamian brothers and sisters. Voting for a Democrat doesn't make you a Democrat. Vote for the person who has ideas and policies that advance your life. Vote for someone who wants to make your life better, who wants to invest in your bottom line, and who wants to create a better Alabama for all of us. If we push that message and say, just because you fill in the circle next to my name, that does not mean you switched parties. It means you put your loyalty to your family and your home above your loyalty to any of these nebulous national parties.
So the next question is about veterans. We have a large concentration of veterans in Southwest Alabama. How do we do a better job of supporting them? And we will start with Mr. Rick Collins.
That's a great question. We have about 66,000 veterans in this congressional district, and that's a high percentage as compared to the nation and even the state. The problem with veterans care, health care, only about 27% of the veterans are using the VA because of travel issues and because it's just such a difficult system to work within. And seeing a VA doctor is difficult. They've passed a couple of laws in recent years that tried to give the option for veterans to use private health providers. And that's a good, it was a good policy idea. The execution hadn't been good because you have to go back through the VA to get approval not to go to the VA. So you're kind of stuck in the same loop. So one of the things I would really focus on is providing greater access to the VA and to private health providers. I think the veterans ought to have that alternative. Thank you.
Dr. Gardner.
So supporting our veterans once they're home from war comes in a lot of different forms. First off, of course, they need health care. Wouldn't it be great if our veterans didn't have to wait months and months to be seen by an orthopedic surgeon? Or perhaps if there was even an orthopedic surgeon in Mobile that took TRICARE right now. I challenge you to find one. So one of the first things we need to do is bring in more providers, expand access to care for our veterans, not just for their bodies, but for their minds. Our veterans are plagued with, we have a problem with veteran suicide. We need to address that, to give them the support they need in order to find health, both mentally and physically, once they're stateside again. Our veterans are prone to low-paying jobs. In fact, it's something like 20% of all of the veterans in Alabama make less than $35,000 a year. We need to invest in job training. We need to have corporate incentives to bring our veterans home and have them hired into positions capable of their skill and their capacity, because these are very high-capacity men and women. We need to invest in trade programs. We need to invest all the way down to a veterans cemetery that is open for all of our veterans in every county, which we also do not have right now. Caring for our veterans is not just about fixing the VA and TRICARE, which we do need to do. It is about looking at the very long life that they will have once they have served, paying them what they're worth, and giving them every opportunity that they deserve.
Dr. Eberhardt.
This is personal to me. I'm a veteran, so I'm not going to tell you about what I heard or what I read. I'm going to tell you about what I know. I deal with the VA. The VA is a great organization. However, in any organization, there needs to be oversight. There must be transparency. I totally would hope that, you know, when we talk about veterans and their care, yes, some things need to take place. We need to streamline some things. But you have to understand the abundance of our veterans and where they're at, especially here in our local communities. A lot of our veterans don't have transportation. Some do. But we have a lot of veterans that are mentally challenged right now. A lot of have TBIs. Some are contemplating suicide on a daily basis. What I would like to see is that we have certified, because it does not matter if an individual, whether they graduated number one in the class or 30 in the class, if they graduate, they can get a job at the VA. I think we should have more highly qualified physicians at the VA taking care of our veterans and more so our dependents. They need help as well. Now, what's important to me, and I see all the time, veterans retiring or getting out the military, they can't get their VA claim. They've been in combat, and they have to do more trying to prove that they was in combat or they got injured at a certain point in time.
Sorry. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm passionate about it. I know I'm a veteran.
I know you are. Thank you very much. Thank you for your service. We've been getting a lot of great comments and questions tonight from people watching on Facebook. Roseanne's been monitoring that, and she has our next question.
Yes, a lot of passionate answers today and some interesting questions. This next one is one that is a hot-button issue, and it has been certainly with the president, and that is border security. The question is, how concerned are you about the nation's border security? Do you think changes need to be made? And if so, what are those changes?
And Keani Gardner, you're first.
So we absolutely need a comprehensive overhaul of our immigration system. Border security is an important issue when you just consider our economy and our population. But the way that we are currently treating refugees, immigrants, and actually just the borders in general is completely erroneous. We need to have a comprehensive change to the way we bring or allow people to come in and out of our country. We need to fund our immigration courts. Right now, people are concerned about how many undocumented immigrants there are inside our country. Well, I would argue to you, find a place, a court, that is seeing these people in a timely manner, and we could cut down on your concern. The border wall, as we've already know, doesn't work. It's an ecological disaster. But with strong policies, we can put forward an immigration plan that allows our country to actually prosper. We need more workers. For the economy that we currently have, we would do well to invest in human capital, to bring qualified and capable, healthy men and women into our country to allow us to continue to, on our pace of growth. What's more, America is built on this very idea of being this great and beautiful country. It is a country that we sell to the rest of the world as the best place to be. And it is, in fact, the best place to be. I am so proud to have been born in this country. But I also know for a fact that if I hadn't been so lucky, I would be desirous of a way to bring my children here. We need to make that way possible for all, for everyone who wants it.
James Eberhardt.
So as I answered the question in regards to border security, I totally agree that that should be border security. I've been out there to the borders, and I see, you know, how the immigrants are being treated in that regards. You know, what I think that there are ways that we can manage the expectations of our country, you know, as it pertains to those coming in. You know, number one way would be biometrics. You know, we do this all the time. Fingerprinting, accountability. That's simply just getting track of, you know, those individuals in case something should take place. You know, so it's about accountability and being transparent in our actions.
And Rick Collins?
I probably share the frustration of the audience that we have, for 30 years, both parties, ignored the immigration issue. And it was very frustrating just to watch it year after year after year. Americans, we just want an orderly process. That's what we've been wanting. And President Trump got in office and overreacted and overcompensated. And so I don't agree with the way he's done. As far as the border wall goes, I guess we're still waiting for Mexico to pay for the wall. But I really think we can use border technologies to solve that issue. I don't think we need to go to the expense of a wall. Thank you.
The next question is about private prisons. Would you support legislation that discourages or eliminates the use of private prisons and private detention centers by the federal government? Why or why not? And we will start with Dr. Gardner.
Yes, I support the end of private prisons, period. Our prison system, particularly our prison system in Alabama, is a human rights violation nightmare. We need a corrections system that focuses on corrections and not imprisonment, that focuses on rehabilitation and not punishment. And when you attach a bottom line, a dollar amount, to any human being, you reduce them to a profit. And that is completely antithetical to the goal or the supposed goal of our correction system. All that does is incentivize the arrest, prosecution, and imprisonment of our citizens. I 100% am opposed to private prisons, period.
Mr. Collins.
I'm not in favor of private prisons, but the crisis in our state, we're operating at 170% of capacity in our prisons in Alabama, and we're recycling prisoners through the drug, alcohol issues, mental health issues. The two largest mental health institutions in our country today is Cook County Jail and the Los Angeles County Jail. That's ridiculous. We do not, and there's some movement to make the prisons more and more involved in mental health. We need to have mental health professionals dealing with mental health issues. The prisons don't need to be taking that over. So focus on rehabilitation, not on just how many more prisons we can build. Thank you.
Dr. Eberhardt.
If I had the power, I would close every private prison down today, right now. However, that is not the case. I do not concur with private prisons. It's a game. It's a business. Pay to play. You're locking these young men and women up. You know, you're keeping them in the system. You know, we need a total reformation as it pertains to our private prisons. The staff members that work at private prisons are more or less underpaid than those that are working at state prisons. You know, you don't have to meet a certain criteria. There's rules to this. I've been to one of the three prisons. And I tell you, if you go visit any state prison or private prison, you'll see a distinct difference from the time you get out your car to go to the gate to give your ID to go in. It's terrible. And we need to change that.
Next, we're going to talk about gun control and whether or not you support expanded background checks or possibly limiting certain types of weapons or magazine capacities. And would you support legislation that required background checks for private gun sales? And we'll begin with Rick Collins.
Yeah, you know, we have right now, if you want to buy a gun, if you go to a federally licensed dealer, they put you through an FBI background check. That covers about 70% of all gun sales. But you've got the loopholes of private sales. If I sell to an individual or internet sale or private gun or gun shows. So if I've got bad intentions with a gun, I'm not going to go to a federally licensed dealer to buy a gun. I'm going to go to the other sources. It makes no sense to have background checks unless it's universal for all gun sales. I'm not against. I'm for the Second Amendment, and I'm not for taking guns away from private citizens for recreation purposes and private protection, but I am for universal background checks. Thank you.
Okay. James Eberhardt?
I believe in the Second Amendment right. I have no intention on supporting any legislation that would take away an individual's gun right. You know, that's part of the Constitution. What I look at as it pertains to gun violence, I do believe that there should be more legislation to have oversight over private gun owners. We need to do that. And the main focus would be to, number one, get those guns out of the hands of criminals and out of the hands of our young people. That is the main reason. We need to add that other layer there for security, you know, and that is, you know, universal background checks is good. You know, on the same token, and I tell anyone, nobody's going to take your gun. It's part of the Constitution. So why are we spending time worrying about that? But we should worry about, you know, getting guns off the street. I can relate to this, you know, some of you may know. My father was killed on the streets of Mobile. So I often talk about having my blood on the streets of Mobile. Some of my friends and relatives were killed. Gun violence. It's serious and it's real. And so we need to do something about it, and we need to be proactive instead of reactive.
Keani Gardner?
Sure. So my husband's a big hunter. We have guns in our home. In fact, shortly after we got married, he wanted me to have my own shotgun so that we could shoot clays together. And we bought it from a private sale. And we showed up, and we gave this man dollars, and he just gave me a gun. And I was just, surely this is not the end of it, and it was. And in that moment, I became very, very aware of just how accessible firearms are. I would never take away someone's gun because I would have to answer to my husband, and he would probably have strong words about that. But because we have guns in our home and are responsible gun owners, we espouse a philosophy of responsibility. I teach my children that guns are tools. They are not toys. They do not play with them. There is no mystique around them. When we have a society that normalizes guns to the way we normalize driving in a car, it should not seem crazy to think we should have the same level of regulation for our guns that we have for cars. There should be background check for every gun sale. We should consider things like registration so that we know who's got guns and how many, and if a gun shows up, we can track it to someplace. I imagine law enforcement would probably be helped by that. We need to treat our guns as ubiquitous as they actually are and be responsible in legislation that removes the mystique and allows people to have their sport, their hobby, in a way that is responsible and is safe.
The next question has to do with our last hot button issue, pro-choice and pro-life. Alabama and several other states recently passed laws outlawing abortions under any circumstances. With the recent federal court appointment of a number of pro-life judges, do you believe that the Roe versus Wade precedent will be overturned? We'll start with Dr. Aveheart?
The answer to your question, sir, is no. I do not believe it will be overturned, you know, and I completely support it, you know, in regards to, as a man, who am I to tell a woman what to do with her body? Okay, so I will support any legislation to actually ensure that Roe versus Wade stay in place.
Dr. Aveheart.
Yep.
Sorry, Dr. Gardner.
Thank you. So I do believe that there's a threat that is being levied against a woman's autonomy. And so I would like to be clear. When we ask this question of pro-choice or pro-life, I am pro-woman. Every pregnancy is life-threatening. Every time a woman is pregnant, she puts her life, her body, on the line for that pregnancy. There's a reason there is a whole field in medicine that is dedicated to caring for a pregnant woman through pregnancy, delivery, and for the time after that. I will always oppose legislation that purports to know a woman's life better than her and her doctor. I will always oppose legislation that seeks to impose upon a woman's ability to make the best choices for her health, for her life, for her family, for her livelihood. I am vehemently pro-woman, and I always will be.
Mr. Collins.
Yes, I'm a lifelong Catholic, and so I'm pro-life. You know, in this debate, we're a lot of times forced to choose between an unborn and the woman. I don't think that's a fair way to do it, you know, because I care for the unborn, obviously, but also for the women facing unplanned pregnancy. It's a terrible dilemma to be in. This is a very divisive issue. Our country is quite divided over it, and it's regrettable. In my opinion, in 1972, the conditions in our country, it was mostly illegal in 46 states with a couple of exceptions. And the Supreme Court was basically forced to deal with the issue because I don't think our families and communities were dealing with it. I don't think we deal with it today. We don't prepare our young people what's coming. The hormonal storm is coming. And I'm guilty of it too. We put our head in the sand and don't prepare them for what's coming. And that urge for our species to survive is pretty powerful. Thank you.
Our next question concerns about what you might do if you get to Washington. If elected, what congressional committees or subcommittees would you like to join and why? And James Aveheart, you're first.
Now I want to join those committees that's going to, actually represent our district. You know, I want to be on those type of committees. You know, I would definitely love to be on the Veteran Appropriation Committee and such. You know, however, infrastructure, definitely, and transportation, that's kind of what affects our area. And so I look forward to be on those type of committees and continue to advocate and watch our coast, you know, our counties grow, you know, watch the economy grow and bring businesses to the area.
All right, Rick Collins.
Of course, I'd love to be on the appropriations and budget committees and environmental committee. There's a lot of committees I'd like to be on. As a freshman, it's not like that I get on the most prestigious ones. It kind of brings up for me the topic of term limits, because right now in the House and the Senate, just because you've been there a long time, you have the best positions. And I think term limits would do away with some of that. Seniority shouldn't be the only criteria for having all the power in the House or the Senate. Thank you.
Okay, Kiani Gardner.
So, as a freshman member of Congress, the likelihood of serving on more than two committees is low. The likelihood of me choosing my committees is also low. But I do feel that since Congress is a federal seat, any congressperson has a responsibility to work their hardest to be on one, the committee that best serves their local community, their district, and then two, on the committee that best utilizes their talents to serve the entire country. Our district most needs infrastructure, and much of our income comes from transportation. The thing that we need most is a very loud and vocal representative on the Infrastructure and Transportation Committee. So that would be something that I'm willing to fight for. Then, as an educator, as a scientist, as someone who entered her professional career investing in the middle class and training tradesmen and workers, I would love to be on the Education and Labor Committee. When I am able to apply my talents to that committee, I envision being able to build policies that don't just impact our workforce here, but actually create a better America.
James Aveheart.
As I've stated, you know, I would prefer to be on the Infrastructure and Transportation Committee. You know, those committees that's going to affect our area.
Okay, and very quickly, Rick brought it up, term limits. James, for or against term limits?
I am for term limits.
Okay, and Keani?
Not only am I for term limits, I've signed a term limit pledge that I will work to produce legislation that limits members of Congress to 3 terms, 6 years.
Thank you.
Okay, and now we are going to the last question of the night, and you actually get a choice. Option one is you can make a traditional closing statement, or you can ask and answer your own question. And we will start with Dr. Gardner for 1 minute.
Absolutely. I'm going to go with a traditional closing statement. Alabama is a beautiful place to live. This is a great state, and District 1 is amazing. But one of the things that we haven't had is actual representation in D.C. fighting for this area. There is a reason that the rest of the country does not think of Alabama when it thinks of the top 10 list of things. Because we keep sending up representation that does not provide the best image of us as a state, of us as a district, of us as a people. It's time to have representation that we can be proud of, representation that we can trust to go to DC and not buy in to the circus of storming the skiff and ordering pizza, representation that would rather work for progressive legislation for our people than spend its time in front of a camera. I am running for Congress not because I want to go to DC. I'm running for Congress because I am called to use my skills and talents to build this district up in a way that is meaningful for you, for me, and for all of our families.
Dr. Averhart.
As I have stated, I'm a servant leader. I want to lead a district. When I see you, I see me. I am you. You know, as I look back over the years and look at how far we've come, you know, this is my community. I am a native Alabamian. I'm your return on investment, and I'm ready to work. You know, and there's a lot of work to be done. Simple.
Mr. Collins.
The bottom line to me is we've got to win this general election. I got in this to win the general election. The Republicans have held this seat for 54 years. They don't have a birthright to this seat or any other seat. We have the winning issues. We have to appeal to Democratic voters, independents, and what I call soft Republican voters in November to win. And one of the big things we're going to have to do is convince donors to get back into the – we're going to need some money to win the election. It's I wish it didn't take money, but it will. And so we have to convince donors to back us and, of course, voters. And I'm the candidate that can do that. Thank you.
And thank you, candidates. I hope you've enjoyed this evening as much as we have. And thank you to the audience as well as GolfQuest for hosting the event tonight. Again, we've been on air live on WKRG. We've been on radio with FM Talk 106.5. We've been on WKRG.com. So hopefully tonight your message and your comments have reached out to a lot of different people here in the 1st Congressional District. And best of luck to you in the primary, which again takes place here coming up in less than 4 weeks on March 3rd. And Robert, you have any closing comments for us?
Well, first of all, I want to thank all the candidates for agreeing to do this when we talked about it oh so many weeks ago. I would like to thank my partner here, Peter, for being a willing person to help me learn how this whole fantastic process works, to my friend Sean Sullivan, who is on the other end working the board at FM Talk 106.5. And for all of you, please tune in to Kennedy for Alabama, which is Friday night at 6 o'clock p.m. on FM Talk 106.5. Thank you, guys.
Good night.